Good morning. We're just going to go ahead and just jump straight in to the scripture this morning. We are in 1 Corinthians 13, and so if we can go ahead and switch that over. Children are dismissed, and if they can't read, I don't know. Can they read? 3 years old? No, they can't. So, all right. So, all right, here we go. 1 Corinthians chapter 13. It's a small chapter. If I speak in the tongues of men and of angels, but have not love, I am a noisy gong or a clanging cymbal. And if I have prophetic powers and understand all mysteries and all knowledge, and if I have all faith so as to remove mountains, but I have not love, I am nothing. If I give away all I have, and if I deliver up my body to be burned, but I have not love, I gain nothing. Love is patient and kind. Love does not envy or boast. It is not arrogant or rude. It does not insist on its own way. It is not irritable or resentful. It does not rejoice at wrongdoing, but rejoices with the truth. Love bears all things, believes all things, hopes all things, endures all things. Love never ends. As for prophecies, they will pass away. As for tongues, they will cease. As for knowledge, it will pass away. For we know in part and we prophesy in part, but when the perfect comes, the partial will pass away. When I was a child, I spoke like a child, I thought like a child, I reasoned like a child. When I became a man, I gave up childish ways. For now we see in a mirror dimly, but then face to face. Now I know in part, then I shall know fully, even as I have been fully known. So now faith, hope, and love abide these three, but the greatest of these is love. How many of you know this chapter? Okay, every wedding. Okay, now I was gonna make fun of Amanda and Kenneth because I'm pretty sure I use that in theirs, and we use it in every wedding. It's on every Christian Valentine's Day card, right? It's when we talk about love, we go here. We don't go anywhere else. We don't go to Deuteronomy, right? We don't go to Revelation. We go to 1 Corinthians 13. I'm not going to preach a sermon on love per se this morning. Because you know what? I don't think this passage is just about love. In fact, I think it's about something a little bit bigger than that, although love is rather huge. We'll see that. Is this passage just about love? Yeah, if you pull it completely out of its context, yeah, love is patient, love is kind. We get a wonderful working definition of what love is at least supposed to look like. Now, what we need to remember is the context, and that is Paul's just got done addressing what in chapter 12? He's been dealing with spiritual things, which in chapter 14, we will learn those things are gifts that come from God, this ability to carry out the work that he has for us, the equipping of us, if you will. And so he gets done talking about spiritual things, and he switches gears for a moment to this whole topic on love. It's not abstract. It's directly connected to it, because what he wants us to understand is why the gifts. Okay, I'm going to talk about gifts. Now, here's why the gifts and what they're for, how they work, and how they don't work. So quite simply, Paul's implying something rather fundamental here, that there are people within Corinth that are saying, you know, we have these gifts, and they've elevated themselves quite highly, but yet they seem not to have love. They're not using love with these gifts by any means. And what Paul is ultimately doing is saying, if you do that, you understand you're a liar. It's not possible to say, I'm doing these things of God and not have love. The other thing Paul is saying about love is that love is going to be the thing that sees us to the end. The only way we're going to make it through all this, and I have to stop and just think for just a minute, the craziness that's happening in Florida right this second, and it's certainly not the only craziness that's happening in the world, it's just the most recent craziness. That all of this stuff that's happening, the only thing that's going to get us through this is this, it's this love. But we need to make sure we understand what this love is, and that's what the whole point of this morning is going to be. We need to understand that absolutely everything around us is temporary. And there's going to come a time when whatever it is that we have found to be the most important things, whatever we have found to be the things that sustain us and we have earned and we have raised up or whatever, all of these things, they're going to no longer be needed. Why is this important? It's because I think here in this particular case, talking about these spiritual gifts, and in particular, Paul's going to be dealing with prophecy and tongues, and we'll deal with that more next week, or actually 2 weeks from now, next week's Father's Day. But as he deals with this, I think what Paul's addressing here is that the Corinthians have found their identity, their importance, their significance in their abilities and skills. They have found their importance here. Now, Romans tells us that we are prone to worship the created rather than the creator. And I think that's in part the problem here in Corinth. Their identity is in what they can do, not who causes them to do it. Remember, if we back up in previous chapter, the purpose of the gifts is what? It's for the body. Okay, that's the church. That's the people that he has gathered together. They were never intended to elevate an individual. They were never to put one person above the rest of them. Never. It's that argument of when the hand says, I have no need of you. That's never part of what the scripture tells us, is it? Understand that when we get to, and this is where we're going, new heaven, new earth, that all of the things that Paul is dealing with here, these gifts, okay, and I'm talking about anything that we think that makes us important and even spiritual things on top of that, all of these things will be obsolete. They won't be necessary. They won't be needed. The only reason we have them now, the only reason God has done this now is because, quite frankly, we are incapable of doing what we need to do without him. That's Paul's point. Now, real quick here, so let's back up for a moment, the gifts. And Paul deals with these gifts passing. And because of this passage, so let's deal with a couple of quick little theological things, and then we'll get back into the heart of the passage itself. There are two views when it comes to the gifts, in particular, because Paul deals with prophecy and tongues. And some of those are odd. Some of those are strange. As I said it a couple weeks back, C.S. Lewis calls them the fantastical. Okay, that these things are odd, and so therefore people usually take a backup approach. Wait a minute, what is this? Right? And so there are two views as to what does it mean by these gifts passing, and when are these gifts used and not used. Now, I mentioned this group before, the secessionists, and quite frankly, if you were to ask me 5, 6, 7 years ago, that's kind of the camp I would have fallen myself into, because that's pretty much what any Baptist church kind of teaches, that there's this place where that the gifts have ceased, or at least specific gifts. Now, there are certain gifts that seem to surround the apostles. Now, keep in mind, that's all we really have a picture of, right, is the apostles. So we have these gifts that surround the apostles, and they serve as a purpose in them in that they validate the apostles. Okay, so, and this is true, this is right, that these guys, whether it be Paul, or it could be Peter, it could be James, it could be John, these things follow them around. They participated in prophecy and tongues and all of these things, and it validated who they were, that they were God's chosen messengers of the gospel, all of these things. But the secessionists would say that they ceased at the apostles. Because here I will say this, the one thing that has ceased is the apostles. Okay, there are a very select number of apostles. And when I say apostles, I'm not talking disciples. Okay, I'm talking about the select few men. Okay, capital A apostle. Right there, and how do I know that? Well, because I have the end of the story, and there happens to be a certain amount of thrones and a certain amount of names around a certain little throne room. It lets us know that there are no more additional apostles. Okay, now who those guys are? Is it Paul? Is it Matthias? Oh, okay, we'll deal with that some other time. But right now, what we need to understand is that if it's just simply to validate the apostles, then how do we explain them happening in any other place? And so I don't believe that they have ceased. I believe the apostles have ceased. And I think this is important to say for this reason. There are men and women who go out proclaiming that they are apostles today. They're on TV. They write books. Stop listening to them. They're not. Okay? They claim, and they do this because they believe they have these gifts, therefore they are apostles, and therefore they have some sort of extra authority. And they hold this authority. This is exactly what Paul's preaching against here. And yet this is what they're doing. So, but on the secessionist side, which is probably the largest view within Christianity, that these gifts have simply ceased with the apostles because they served only one purpose, ultimately, was to validate the apostles in God's glory and his work and what he was doing. Now, the other side to it, though, is that there is those who would say that the gifts were given to the church, true, and they were given to the church, so therefore they're given to the church age. Now, the church age, what does that mean? It simply means the time we have Christ who dies, rose again, and then he ascends to heaven. As he ascends, the Holy Spirit comes down. We call that Pentecost. And at that moment is when we say the true beginning of the church age happened. Now, some could actually take it back to Caesarea Philippi when Jesus says, Peter, you're the rock. There it is. But the idea is that time period forward is the church age, and that the gifts are for the church age, and the gifts will be in use. And this is what I believe Paul is saying here, the gifts will be in use until Christ's return. That the gifts are for the church as the church has need. So therefore, if a gift is not represented within a church body, that there's more than likely, what does that mean? It means that church doesn't need that right now. But it will be there when it is needed. I do not believe our God is a redundant God. I don't think he takes one church and some. Why would one church have an overabundance of one thing and another church have absolutely none of it? Okay, there seems to be, I don't know, something going on there that just doesn't seem quite right when we put an emphasis. And that's what Paul is talking about here. Quit putting the emphasis on the gift, put the emphasis on the gift giver. Okay, so I want to kind of throw that out there. And then the other theological sticking point I just want to make sure we're clear on comes here. Just get it out of the way. Paul is not inferring, he is not saying that he knows a secret language of angels. That's not what Paul is saying. It's not what he's saying at all. What is he saying? He's giving some extremes here, and this isn't, again, this is important. What language do angels speak? Does anybody know? I don't know. I'm pretty sure it's probably English, right? Because, I mean, that's what everybody speaks who's intelligent, right? No, it's not. That's not how that works. None of this was in English. We understand that, right? You have a translation of a translation. That's what you have here. So understand, the angels, did they speak Aramaic? Did they speak Hebrew? Did they speak Greek? Yeah. And did they speak English? Sure. I'm pretty sure angels are probably not limited. I'm just going to throw that one out there. Okay? And so the idea here, Paul is not saying that there is a secret language that we can know. And there are people out there who would teach you that. There are people, and they would call themselves apostles, by the way. And they would tell you that you're not saved unless you know the language of angels. Do you understand this is the only time Paul ever brings it up? Do you understand it's the only time it's ever brought up in all of Scripture? You know why? Because he's just using it as an example. It's just an extreme. And you talk about extremes, okay? Here you have an earthly being. Here you have a supernatural being. If I talk in this language or if I talk in this language. That's what he's going with. He's just saying, do you understand? I can talk like a man. I can talk like an angel. Now, again, remember who the angels were or are. They're messengers, right? That's what the word angel means, messenger. Okay, they're a messenger. They usually herald some sort of great and powerful message from God himself. Okay, so that's what we see throughout the Scripture. That's what they do. Okay, so the implication would be that if somebody could stand up and say, I have the tongues of angels, would be to say what? I have a very powerful and important message that's been imparted to me, just like it would have been imparted to, say, Michael. That puts me up pretty high, doesn't it, if I can proclaim that. And Paul's saying, even if I could, not that I'm going to, but even if I could, if I don't have love, it doesn't really matter. And that becomes the kicker to it. You can be as impressive as you want, but if you have no love, and we're going to define what that love means, but if I have no love, it doesn't mean anything. Too much false theology has been built around these verses. Too many empires have been built on these verses, let alone one that's happening in the Vatican, but I'm just leaving that one there too. Paul isn't talking about whether you're saved or not saved because you do or you don't. He's saying none of those things matter without love. In fact, the point is simple. If I speak at all, and I do it without, if I do it void of love, it's just noise. So Paul brings up tongues, he brings up prophecy, he'll do that again in chapter 14. And the question was, you know, the question everybody asked is, why does that seem to be, like, Paul seems to be beating a dead horse with this. He brings it up in 12, he brings it up in 13, he's going to bring it up in 14. Why is that? Because I think the Corinthians had a problem with it. I think there were some people who were abusing it, and Paul's calling them on it. Remember, he has reports. There's a he didn't just randomly pick these two gifts. And it's not because these two gifts are so incredible versus everything else. These seem to be the sticking point. So the picture that's painted is that, quite frankly, only special Christians, right, more valued and trusted by God are given certain gifts, and the ones who aren't so valued are given lesser gifts. That's what's being taught in Corinth. And Paul's saying, no, that's false, because that in and of itself would not even demonstrate God's love. And if it does not demonstrate that, then and it doesn't demonstrate the fact that the gifts are given for the body, not for the individual, so therefore the gift is not a reward for the faithful. In fact, I'm pretty sure that if you went and you asked Moses, who I believe had the gift of tongues in the sense that he was given a message to go and share, he was given the gift of prophecy because he had a message to go and share. I'm pretty sure if you asked him if it was a gift, he would say no. He didn't want to go. So let's quit looking at some of these things as if they are somehow a reward. I am a better servant, therefore I have this gift. No. I find it interesting that depending, though, on your experience with these two particular, prophecy, tongues, that really kind of changes how you look at these verses. Now, again, the secessionists would say they ceased, often because they're kind of too strange. I, for one, have seen abuse with these particular gifts. I have seen entire cities turned upside down because one man falsely proclaims that God told him an earthquake was coming. I watched elderly sell their homes, pennies on the dollar, only for that earthquake never to come. I watched Harold Camping convince the world that the end was coming. Oh, sorry, I got the date wrong. It'll be this day. Oh, wait, one more time. I don't know, after the first time, I think there was something we were supposed to do, but we didn't do that. There's something about false prophets and those who would abuse the idea of these gifts. People who seek authority, people who seek high seats. And we forget these are gifts from God to build his church, not scare his church. When Paul says at the end of 12 that there are still more excellent things, he's not talking about even more gifts. There are people who think that what happens is this. They go, oh, he says more excellent things. Quick, where is it? And they're flipping through it, and they go right past chapter 13, which they go right past the more excellent thing. The more excellent thing is all of anything that you do if it's done out of the love that God gives. You understand, a community that can love, a community that is love, is unstoppable. But the sad truth is there are people out there who think that because perhaps they've participated in spiritual things, because they hold high seats, perhaps even on a church board or something to that effect, that somehow that God has elevated them, and even perhaps that God even owes them. And these are verses that I keep connecting back to the Corinthians, because I think Jesus is talking to some of the Corinthians in this passage. Not everyone who says to me, this is Jesus speaking, Lord, Lord, will enter the kingdom of heaven. But the one who does the will of my Father who is in heaven, and on that day many will say to me, Lord, Lord, did we not prophesy in your name, cast out demons in your name, do many mighty works in your name? And then will I declare to them, I never knew you, depart from me, you workers of lawlessness. Lord, Lord, aren't we so great? Didn't we build a wonderful tower for you? I don't remember asking you to build a tower for me. Didn't I go to Tadmore? I worked at Tadmore. Didn't I do that, Lord? Didn't I wear my Christian shirt out in public? Didn't I attend that one rally? Don't I do relational elder training every Tuesday with Mike? I find it interesting that nowhere in this passage does it say, they will say to him, Lord, Lord, didn't we see you do this? It's, Lord, Lord, didn't we do this? Didn't I do this? Jesus continues this thought over in John. If you love me, you will keep my commandments. It's not if you love me, you will think about my commandments. If you love me, you might try my commandments. If you love me, you might memorize my commandments. You will keep my commandments. And I will ask the Father, and he will give you another helper, that's the Spirit, to be with you forever, even the Spirit of truth, whom the world cannot receive because it neither sees him or knows him. You know him, for he dwells with you and will be in you. I will not leave you as orphans. I will come to you. That's a return. Yet a little while, and the world will see me no more, but you will see me. Now, real quick here, how will we see him? I don't see him where... Yes, I do see him. I see him in quite a few places. That's the idea here. Because I live, you also live. It doesn't say, because you live, I live. Does it? I think sometimes that's the way we flip-flop that sometimes. God exists because I say so. In that day, you will know that I am in my Father, and you in me, and I in you. Whoever has my commandments and keeps them, he it is who loves me. And he who loves me will be loved by my Father, and I will love him and manifest myself to him. Judas, and John wants to make sure we know, not Iscariot, because that Judas would never ask this question, said to him, Lord, how is that you will manifest yourself to us and not to the world? That's a confusing question. Jesus answered, if anyone loves me, he will keep my word, and my Father will love him. You notice how Jesus just kind of repeats himself. And he will come to him and make our home with him. Whoever does not love me does not keep my words, and the word that you hear is not mine, but the Father's who sent me. If you love me, you will keep my commandments. And by the way, what are those commandments? Love God, love others. He says it twice in this passage and reaffirms it multiple times. This is what it means. And do we also see how the triune God is at work here? That if you love me, that's Jesus speaking, I will ask the Father, okay, and he will send what? The Spirit. There's an intertwining that's happening because, quite frankly, we can't do it on our own. And he'll send somebody who's going to do this for us. He's going to work within us. And what is Jesus saying? He's saying, you know what? I want you to follow my commandments. I want you to keep my commandments. And you know what? I don't expect you to be able to do it by yourself. So I'm going to help you do it. That's what he's saying here. And he says, I will come to you. I'm coming back for you. And then the question, how are we going to know this, Lord? How are we going to know any of this? How will it manifest? And that manifest, that word manifest is disclose in some translations, but the word is empanizo. It's where we get the word emphasize from. Lord, how will you emphasize your here? Well, if you love me and you follow my commandments, which will be to love others, you're going to see me. It's going to be pretty clear. What Paul wants us to grasp is that the works, understand this, hold on to this, the works don't matter. At the end of the day, the works themselves don't matter. It's not doing incredible things. It's understanding why we would do such incredible things. And he goes on and says, you know, I could give it all away, or my body could be burned. Now, he says, like, he's referencing here, this should cause them to think of other things. And so, if I give it all away, right? So, Jesus says, thus, when you give to the needy, sound no trumpet before you as the hypocrites do in the synagogues and in the streets, that they may be praised by others. Truly, I say to you, they have received their reward. You want my reward? Just do it. Don't make a big deal about it. Don't carry the banner out. And just go do that. And he says, I'll deliver my body to be burned. If I do that, I have not love. Immediately, the thoughts would have to go to, at least for me, I go to Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. I mean, here are three young men who, for the love of God, and quite frankly, for the love of Nebuchadnezzar himself, said, you know what, you can throw us in there, and even if our God does not save us, Jim Elliot, he is no fool who gives up what he cannot keep to gain what he cannot lose. The man loved a group of people that he never even met, lost his life over it. No, gave his life over it. What is this love? What is this love that he's talking about? And you know this passage. Everybody, in fact, I think people have memorized this passage without even realizing they memorized this passage. And the thing is, I don't know, maybe we've turned it into something that it's not. You know, love's patient and it's kind. Yeah, okay. So do we know what patience and kindness mean and all those kind of things? Have we looked at that first? First, I want to make sure we understand this. What does this mean? It means that first we need to toss aside our world's notion of love in order to understand it. Because the world's definition of love is upside down. Because understand, love is not a feeling. And that's what happens here. Love is not a feeling. Love is a behavior. One of my favorite messages I think I ever heard on the topic of love was one particular pastor. He said, it's funny how we use the word love. He says, I say, I love my wife, and I love my family, I love my children, and I love tacos. And he's like, how is it that I can love tacos and love my wife the same? And he says, and if I do, I have a problem, and I might not have a wife that much longer, right? I mean, but the idea is that we use love wrong. So if I'm going to start quoting people, if I'm going to talk about love, I think there's only one person I personally go to straight to, Corrie Ten Boom. If you know Corrie Ten Boom's story, she Nazis and Holocaust and prison, and she survived. Family didn't. This is what she says. She says, do you know what hurts so very much? It's love. Love is the strongest force in the world. So that doesn't sound like a feeling to me. And when it is blocked, that means pain. There are two things that we can do when this happens. We can kill that love so that it stops hurting. But then, of course, part of us dies too. Or we can ask God to open up another route for that love to travel. Okay, I can't quote her once. I got to quote her twice. This is concerning her captors. Even as the angry, vengeful thoughts boiled through me, I saw the sin of them. Jesus Christ had died for this man. Was I going to ask for more? Lord Jesus, I prayed, forgive me and help me to forgive him. Jesus, I cannot forgive him. Give me your forgiveness. And so I discover that it is not on our forgiveness any more than our goodness that the world's healing hinges, but on his. And when he tells us to love our enemies, he gives along with the command the love itself. God does not say, love me and love others the only way you can. He says, love me, love others with this. Patience, kindness, not envy, not boasting. And let's not minimize these words. If you go deeper into these words, you find out there's a... This is not just, I think he ignored me just by walking by. That's not what rude means here. Rude means a whole lot, something more vicious than that. But ultimately, it all adds up to wrongdoing. And understand that I don't see patience, kindness, envy, boasting, arrogant, rude, any of these things. Are any of these feelings? They're not feelings, are they? They're what? They're actions. So I guess my question is this. Why do we reduce love to a feeling, but yet what it's being compared to or what it's being anti-compared to is what? It's they're not feelings, they're actions. So therefore, love must be what? An action. It must be something that is active. Okay. So I, and some of you know this, I've been getting myself into a routine lately. If there's anything I'm good at is finding a routine. I'm working out. And this is something I have not done in years past. And I'm working out. Now, there are days when I wake up and I go, I just wish I felt like I was working out. Now, do you understand that if I sit in bed and I go, I really feel like I want to work out, but I don't actually get up. Do you understand? I will not gain any result from that, right? In fact, if nothing else, I'll probably get worse. I can't feel like I want to do something and have it get done. I have to actually get up and do it. I'm sorry about that. I have an update, apparently. Why is it that we think that we can just feel love? feeling like doing something is not the same as doing it. And again, I'm going to quote some more here, but this time at least you'll have some graphics to go with it. This comes from a message from Francis Chan. And Adam Ford, who does some comics, did an incredible little job with this one, I think. I like it. My computer has frozen. This is good. All right. It really has. It has frozen. Yeah, I guess I should have updated. Oh, there we go. Let's go back to... I'll just start over. I'm just kidding. And we'll get there. There it is. All right. So, maybe you've heard this one. Okay, father talking to a daughter. Hey, sweetie, did you clean your room yet? Oh, you're going to be so impressed, daddy. I memorized exactly what you said to me. You said, go clean your room, hun. And guess what? After a little bit of practice, I can even say, go clean your room in Greek. That's awesome. Some friends and I even organized a weekly small group to read and discuss some of the latest books on room cleaning methods and disciplines. Well, that's all super great, kiddo, really. So this might be a dumb question, but did you actually clean your room, right? I hadn't had time. Understand that love is active, something that we can't just think about, but we actually have to do, which indicates not only is it an action, but, well, actually, I need to back up here because let's get into some of this Greek for a moment here. It kind of makes it sound like love is a verb, right? And we say that. In fact, I think DC Talk sang it, right? Love is a verb. And understand that the word that Paul's using here, it's a word that I think most people know, agape. And if you know any Greek, you know agape. It's not a verb. It's a noun. It's interesting. Paul, when he says love throughout this passage, he uses a noun. In fact, this word agape is used 9 times in 1 Corinthians, and understand 6 of them are in chapter 13 alone. And that this is not a verb. In fact, there is a verb for it that gets translated love, and that's agapoa. Agapoa is used twice in 1 Corinthians, not once in chapter 13. It's used in chapter 2 and chapter 8. Why is Paul using a noun here? Why is that important? Now remember, Paul's addressing an identity issue with the Corinthians. They are a disunified bunch. They have either a lack of identity or an overemphasis on identity. And the question becomes, what identifies you? What makes you different? What sets you apart? What makes you different than them? And if you're too busy trying to identify yourself, is that what you're doing? You're just too busy trying to say, this is who I am? Or are you identified by who he is and what he has done? So if we were to read it again, this time knowing that love is a noun, love is patient and kind. Love does not envy or boast. It is not arrogant or rude. It does not insist on its own way. It is not irritable or resentful. It, and this, all those its are love, does not rejoice at wrongdoing, but rejoices with the truth. Love bears all things, believes all things, hopes all things, endures all things. Suddenly this personification of love is what does these things. This is who love is. And if we reverse it, we see that it's anything but love. And Paul's response to that is stop it. It's just that simple. Stop it. Love bears all things. The word bears, it means to cover. In fact, it means to cover in silence. In other words, it's one of those moments where I don't have to be vocal on this one. I'm just going to love you. Love believes all things. That's more than just simply giving the benefit of the doubt. There's a confidence in it. Now, love endures all things. And we talked about that word endure. It means to put up with, even in those times when you have to be silent and bite your tongue. And often I think love is best expressed with bitten tongues. If it was a feeling, yeah, you have an excuse, right? You have an excuse to be all of these other things because it's a feeling. It comes and it goes. I don't understand. People say, I fell out of love. You don't fall out of love. You fall out of trees, yes. You don't fall out of love. What you do is you chose to stop loving. That's what you did. And if you're in a relationship and you fall out of love, then I would say it was not love that you had in the first place. You had something, and I'm not even going to diminish what that is, but please stop calling it love. Because one does not fall out of love. One either chooses to love or chooses not to love. And this, This is how God chooses to identify his children. Love. Now, Paul switches gears, and he goes from this notion of here's what love is, and how it happens right here, right now. And now he says, but you understand that this love is about moving forward to a future place. It has future ramifications. Because he begins by simply saying love never ends. That is the most brazen statement, to say that something could never end. What does that mean? It connects with this notion that there is going to be, and it's a promise that was given to David, the Davidic covenant, that there will be a forever kingdom that will come, a forever throne. And amongst this forever, because that's what never ends means, it's forever. Love will be there. Now, he says prophecies and tongues and knowledge, all of that's going to pass away, which means what? They're not forever. The only thing that Paul says is forever in this sentence is love. And that is so, so very important, because this is in the context of heaven. This is in the context of new heaven, new earth. Now, if the purpose of prophecy is to speak the truths about God, right? If that's the purpose, do we need to do that when we're in his very presence? I don't have to speak the truths of God because he's there. There's no longer need to share with somebody what God looks like when he's right there. Tongues, knowledge, positions, popularity. Whatever it is that you find your role and you think your role is so vital to the kingdom, do you understand your role doesn't exist in the kingdom? He exists in the kingdom. You exist with him in the kingdom. All of these things, they cease at the gates. They're not needed. Paul says we these are things that we know in part. In other words, I don't know everything, but I am fully known. This is the beauty of it. I don't know everything about God. Don't. God knows everything about me, though. That's all that's necessary. And when I'm with him, I will know everything about him. That blows my mind. At the end of the day, what do we say? He who dies with the most toys still dies. It doesn't matter what it is that you have amassed. It doesn't matter the positions and the plaudits and the pulpits and the whatever. It doesn't matter. All of those things at the end of the day don't matter, because all that will matter, everything will pass away. All that will matter is that I'm seeing him. And Paul then goes on to say that this is like I was a child and I gave up the childish things. And now he compares this to looking in a mirror dimly. And that's an odd thing. I don't know. Most people don't look in a mirror in the dark. So what is Paul saying here? Well, we got to understand, what does a mirror look like back then? And back then, a mirror was not, we have too many ways of looking at ourselves today, right? I can turn the reverse camera on my phone. I can see myself, and we've made an entire culture on myself, right? I mirrors everywhere. Okay, all sorts of different places that we can get our reflection. Now, for back then, understand that a mirror wasn't the way it is now. A mirror would have simply been a piece of flat metal that would have been highly polished. Now, I don't know about you, I've seen some pretty shiny stuff, but when you're polishing rough metal by hand, that's not a true reflection, is it? It can get pretty close, but it's not a true reflection. You understand that these people, understand Paul, before getting to heaven, I don't even know if it mattered in heaven, but you understand, the closest they ever got to see them, their own, what they actually look like, what everybody else sees, the closest thing they ever got to was a dim comparison. I don't know if you ever thought about that. I mean, that's what, when he says, a mirror dimly, that the best reflection they could get, maybe if the water would just stay smooth long enough. But they never actually knew what they truly, truly looked like. And yet God knows exactly what you look like. He knows exactly what it is. James tells us, we can look in a mirror and walk away and totally forget. And, and we think about it today, and that's ridiculous. Because, I just pick up my phone. It wasn't an option. The only view they had of themselves was actually already a distorted view. You ever look at a picture of yourself and go, that's what I look like? Why didn't somebody tell me? You will see the flaws. You will see all these things. And Paul's saying, you know what? None of that's going to matter. You got to remember something. We're his masterpiece. We're his poema. We were made in his image. That never changed. Yeah, there was a fall. And yeah, there's corruption that kind of goes in that. But at the end of the day, we're still in his image. But our image, the image that we truly know, is so dim compared to his glory. And yet that very same glory is the glory that he called you to. The same glory that you will experience in a new heaven and a new earth and be fully known and know him fully. And if you think about all those anti-love things, I mean, those are pretty ugly things, right? We say things like envy rears its ugly head or whatever. Have you ever heard love rears its ugly head? Oh, no. Why? Because love is something so much more beautiful than this. So if we see the picture, or maybe perhaps we don't see the picture, because here's the reality is that before Christ, we were in utter darkness. We were blinded. But now as we come into his marvelous light, as Peter would say, there's no room to hide, but you know what? There's no need to hide. Do you understand that? When God brings you into his light, he doesn't go, oh, whoa, turn the light back off. That's not God. God does not cover himself. Now, interestingly enough, when we see God, when you have Moses seeing God, there's a covering. He can't handle it. But God doesn't look at me and go, oh, what did I do? And we need to make sure we understand that when he brings us into the light, he's fully aware before you get into the light exactly what you look like, and he loves you all the same. Paul's reference to a dimly lit mirror is to say the best we can manage to grasp pales in comparison to what is already true. And that's what we need to understand. So we need to understand that this faith, hope, and love, faith is an action, yet Paul uses a noun for this word as well. It's a conviction that God exists and that Jesus is Messiah. Faith is what saves us. We are saved by faith alone. Faith is an action, but yet it is a noun that Paul uses here. Hope is an action, and yet Paul uses also a noun here. And it's a joyful, confident expectation of eternal salvation. Hope sustains us. Hope is a noun. Love is an action, but we've already learned this one. It's a noun. It's an affection, it's goodwill, it's benevolence, it's brotherly. Love fuels us. Paul uses three nouns, not three verbs. There are verb versions of these words, and he uses them freely other places. But Paul has chosen to use nouns here, and this is important. Why? Because Mike likes to do Greek gymnastics. No, because these are identity words. These are who we are. This is who Christians are. We are to be this. These are our names. Our names are faith, hope, and love. We need to understand that. See, how I live these things now represents what I believe to be true in heaven. Paul isn't telling us we need to just get along and love one another just for the sake of now. It's because, quite frankly, at the end of the day, because love is the only thing that's going to carry over, you guys are going to have to put up with each other for eternity, so start getting used to it now. And that's what he's saying. And you know what? In order for us to do it now, we're going to need all the faith and all the hope we can get. We don't need faith and hope in new heaven and new earth, but yet Paul is saying we will still need love when we are there. Faith and hope are dependent on future events, promises kept from past events that we believe to be true. And yet love is the thing that goes all the way through the whole thing. Hebrews tells us, now faith is the assurance of things hoped for, the convictions of things not seen. Here we're talking about in a mirror dimly. Jesus says, blessed are you because you have seen. Blessed more are what? Those who haven't. Right? I mean, that's this picture here, that our faith isn't something that's hoped for. And then over in Romans, he says, for in this hope we were saved. Now hope that is seen is not hope. You catch that? Hope that is not seen, or hope that is seen is not hope. For who hopes for what he sees? I don't have to hope my present is what I want if I can see my present. Now if it's wrapped, I have all the anxiety that goes with that. But if we hope for what we do not see, we wait for it with what? Patience. Oh, what's the definition of patience? Love. 2 Corinthians, for we walk by faith, not by sight. We walk by faith, not by sight. Consider that when we are with him, we will be face to face with him. No more darkness, no more blindness. Everything that we think we see clearly now is nothing but a dim mirror. I need faith to get through my day. I do. I'm weak. I need faith. I need hope to get through my day. There are days I am not hopeful. But there are days, more days than I can count, that I am convinced I do not need love. Because what it is I've reduced love to something other than what it is. It's not my identity. It's not who I am. I can get by with faith on God, and I get by with faith and hope in God, but I'm perfectly fine holding myself up in a room with nobody else around me and not have love. I'm not fine. John Calvin says, each person derives personal blessings from his own faith and hope, whereas love is poured out for the good of others. See, faith and hope, that's about me, but love, that's not about me. That's for somebody else. And he says, faith, hope, love, they abide. They need to be together right now for a time. But in the end, everything goes, including the gifts. Yet love remains, love endures, love puts up with us. We see this incredible peace in a new heaven and a new earth. You know why? Because I don't have to have faith that it's going to happen. It's happening. I don't have to have a hope that it's going to happen because it's happening. One commentator says it this way: in this life, faith, hope, and love are all challenges which we need to support and which believers are exhorted to meet. And if we were not so challenging to love people in this world, the scriptures would not spend so much time commanding and exhorting us to love. In the life to come, it will be a delight to love and not a challenge. Let me say that one more time. I am a father of teenagers. In the life to come, it will be a delight to love and not a challenge, just as it will no longer be a challenge to trust God or to have hope in him. Paul finishes out this thought going into the next one: pursue love. Yeah, you can desire the gifts. I'm not saying ignore the gifts, but pursue love. Later on, and he goes, let all that you be done in love, as a noun, as an action, not just a feeling. In fact, actually, next week is Father's Day. 1 Corinthians 16:14. I can't just pull that one out. I got to go back a verse. Be watchful. Stand firm in the faith. Act like men. Be strong. Let all that you do be done in love. I don't know about you. I did not grow up in an atmosphere. I'm not saying I grew up in a bad atmosphere. I did not grow up in an atmosphere where being a man equaled doing everything in love. They were very separate. I've had a lot of things in culture try to tell me these are separate. Apparently, to be a man, you have to do things in love. I'm just going to claim that truth from Paul right there. Paul says at the end of chapter 12, I will show you still a more excellent way. And then he proceeds to talk about love. So be careful not to miss this. I think we read chapter 12 and again, we go, oh, there's a more excellent way, and we skip. We skip through all of these things. The more excellent way is love. It's doing whatever it is that you do already because of love. It's not, well, I guess I could slide it in there a little bit. It's not about, well, you know what, I don't feel loved. That's great. Nobody feels loved. I don't know what it is that you feel, but quit using the word loved. Maybe I don't feel appreciated. Maybe I don't, okay, that's fine. I'll validate that one. But love is who we are, not what we're doing. It's who we are. This is the more excellent way. Because this is the thing that will remain. There's this picture. I'm going to ask the worship team to go ahead and come forward. And there's this picture that Jesus says, everything's going to be tested by fire, right? And so we have this picture, and it's a horrible picture if you stop and think about it. Because I don't know how many of you have built your homes, okay, who have invested greatly in your homes. But the last thing you want to see is somebody say, let's test who you are by setting your house on fire. And this is what God says. It's all going to burn. You don't get to take it with you. I prepared a room for you. You're not taking your room with you. Leave the luggage behind. I've got you covered, literally. Right? And so everything burns down, and anything that remains is good. What's going to remain? Love. Love is what remains. Not my board game collection. Not my yo-yos. Not all my toys. Love. Love is what remains. Not the foundation of my house. Nothing. But love. Love remains. It remains, and it needs to exist now. Love is not a promise. Love is a command. Love is not something for tomorrow. Love is right now. Faith, hope will get me to tomorrow. Love is now. I don't think I've used this phrase in a while, so I'm going to. If you have a problem with that, you need to deal with it. You need to get used to it. You need to man up, woman up, people up, whatever. You got to get used to it. Because this is what it is. And I cannot think of a... I've had a lot of people do a lot of things that have demonstrated love in my life. Next week, I will talk a little bit about my grandfather. And you want to talk about a man who didn't know Jesus at the time, but demonstrated love in incredible ways. I'll just give you the end of the story. He knows Jesus, and so I know where he's at. And I wait for that day. But he did a lot of things that demonstrated love. My mom's done a lot of things. My dad, my family, you. And yet, the greatest picture of love that can ever exist for us now in this dimly lit, mirrored kind of place is right here at this table. To understand that he says, this is my body I give to you, because you don't have to give your body. And this is my blood, which I give to you, because it's not about your blood, it's about my blood. It's a new covenant. It's a forever kingdom that was promised to David is being promised to you. You are part of this. Now, as we enter into this church age and we look forward to this millennial kingdom thing, this picture of new heaven, new earth, and to understand that here is faith and hope demonstrated in love. And one day, you know what? When I'm with Jesus, I won't have to take the bread. I'm not going to be with Jesus and say, Jesus, when do we take communion? Because I am in communion. And today, though, today I have to take the bread. Today I have to take the cup to remind me of he's coming. And this is why we gather, because of his love, that we might love, that people who we perhaps think don't deserve love understand that it's not a feeling, but it's a reality. And yes, they do, because they deserve it just as much as I did when I was a filthy sinner in the darkness. I'm in his light. Why do I think I'm so special that somebody else doesn't get to either? I'm not. That's the beauty. Let's pray. Father God, we thank you so much. We thank you for the for the love, the faith, the hope. Father, I thank you for the gift of your Son. Father, I know that in this world, love has a lot of definitions, and so many of them are so lacking. Father, right now, I know that our country looks at Florida, and all we see is hate. And Father, quite frankly, that's all the world has to offer. I pray that somebody loves them. I pray that we're on this other side of this country and we can love them. Father, I pray that we might love our neighbors. We might love our brothers and our sisters and our families and our community. But Father, I pray that it's not something that just comes and goes, but that we are just demonstrated by that, and that to hear those words, that they will know us by our love, not by my preaching and our preaching, and not by how many things we have accomplished, and not by our incredible submarine float, but they will know because we love. We thank you, we praise you, we give you all the glory. Amen.